It's the end of an era as Japan quits negative interest rates. Plus, NVIDIA reveals new AI chips at its latest conference, dubbed AI Woodstock. And Israel sends officials to Washington amid Biden's growing concerns over a potential invasion of Rafah.
Our position is that Hamas should not be allowed a safe haven in Rafah or anywhere else. But a major ground operation there would be a mistake.
It's Tuesday, March 19th. I'm Kate Bullivant for The Wall Street Journal. And here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We begin in Japan this morning, where the country's central bank has ended a historic run of negative interest rates, raising rates for the first time in 17 years. It marks a milestone for one of the world's biggest economies amid a strengthening job market and a new era of stable inflation. Joining me now is the Journal's Tokyo Bureau Chief, Peter Landers. Peter, a significant move from the BOJ today. Tell us, what did they say?
They say Japan is on the road to stable inflation of about 2%. We've already been above that level for about 2 years now. And in light of that, the Bank of Japan says it's time to end these extraordinary monetary policy steps that it's taken over the last 14 years or so. They've ended negative interest rates. That was one of the most prominent steps. They've also ended an attempt to target the yield on 10-year Japanese government bonds. That's something that central banks don't normally do. The Bank of Japan has been doing that for nearly 8 years. They were initially setting a target of around zero. Now the target is being scrapped entirely. Now, the purpose of this was to control not just short-term rates, which is the traditional ambit of the central bank, but also longer-term rates. So a company borrowing money that it needs to pay back over 10 years, that would be linked to the interest rate on the 10-year Japanese government bond. So if that interest rate is zero, that means that companies and consumers can borrow at extremely low rates. And that was the point of having this yield curve control. What the Bank of Japan is saying now is that it's okay to let the market determine that interest rate on the 10-year Japanese government bond. That's what markets usually do. And right now, it's just slightly above 0.7%. So it's still very easy to get a loan at a low interest rate in Japan if you're a qualified borrower, whether you're a business or a person buying a home. Interest rates are still very low. And that is why the Bank of Japan felt that it didn't need to control that interest rate so strictly.
And Peter, this comes off the back of a rebounding economy, right? Something we've been reporting on in recent months, not least last week, when the biggest trade union secured major wage increases for workers there.
I think those wage numbers were a big deal for the Bank of Japan, showing that at least at large companies in Japan, the average wage increase this year is going to top 5%. And that's the biggest we've seen since 1991. So what they've really wanted to see all along is what they call a virtuous cycle of wages and prices. And we've had prices going up 2%, 3%, 4% over the last couple of years. And the question was whether wages would follow, because until now, wages have been going up a little bit, but a lot of people are actually losing out in their daily lives because they're paying a lot more and they're only earning a tiny bit more. Now, finally, with these wage numbers in place, the Bank of Japan can say people are seeing the benefits of positive inflation, a tight job market. Companies are passing on some of their higher profits to their workers, and that signals a healthy economy. That means they don't need to have some of these emergency monetary policy steps.
So how does this compare with other economies around the world? In the US, the Fed begins its meeting today, but there the conversation is quite different to what Japanese policymakers are dealing with.
That's right. And the Bank of Japan is saying its monetary policy is still extraordinarily accommodative, they call it. That means it's easy to get credit at a very low interest rate. So the policy rate that they're setting today is between 0 and 0.1%. Now, that's hardly tight monetary policy. In the U.S., it's above 5%. So there's still a large interest rate gap between the U.S. and Japan, and that has tended to weaken the yen. The yen is, in fact, weakening a bit further today in light of the Bank of Japan saying that they don't intend to have a series of rapid rate increases after today's action.
Okay, so an improving economy, but not quite. quite matching the strength of the US economy. Are there other caveats here that investors need to be aware of?
I would say two caveats. One is domestic, that people in Japan, they don't actually feel the economy is all that great. They have been hit by higher inflation, and just now they're beginning to see these wage increases. And so consumer spending in Japan is actually not all that strong. And then the other risk is more external, pointed out by the Bank of Japan itself today. They actually took a cautious outlook about the global economy. They said Japan's economy is likely to be under downward pressure stemming from a slowdown in the pace of recovery in overseas economies. So countries like China are having a lot of economic difficulties. Even the U.S. economy is not growing all that rapidly. And those are the two biggest markets overseas for Japanese goods. Further, we have, of course, a U.S. presidential election this year, all kinds of uncertainties in overseas markets that the Bank of Japan is saying might require a revision to the economic outlook.
Sounds like a case of wait and see, Peter. Thanks so much for talking us through the news of the day. That was Peter Landers, our Tokyo Bureau Chief.
Sure thing.
Another keenly watched market event was NVIDIA's annual tech conference last night, where it unveiled its highly anticipated new chips, Blackwell. Roughly 11,000 people filled the SAP Center in San Jose, California, to hear NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang talk about the $2 trillion company's next generation of chips and how they will power artificial intelligence. According to Huang, the chips are much faster and larger than their predecessors and will be available later this year. With investments in AI skyrocketing, NVIDIA's quarterly sales have more than tripled over the past year. Meanwhile, shares in Google parent Alphabet jumped 6% Monday, following a report by Bloomberg that Apple may use Google's generative AI tool called Gemini to power features in upcoming iPhone models. Katie Bonato is a markets editor for the journal, and she says the report helped fuel a wider rally in tech shares yesterday as investors continue to focus on any and all AI news.
Players like Apple, which haven't been able to make their footstep yet on AI, are really trying very hard now to catch up there. So that's pretty exciting because it involves two huge tech players potentially working together.
That said, it remains unclear whether such a deal will come to fruition. And Apple is also said to have previously met with OpenAI for discussions on licensing their large language model. Coming up, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Biden speak for the first time in a month amid a growing divide between the two allies. And more women are choosing the abortion pill. We've got those stories and more after the break.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of The Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has agreed to send a team of Israeli officials to Washington to discuss U.S. concerns over a planned operation in the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which Israel says is Hamas's last holdout in the Strip. It comes after the Israeli leader and President Biden spoke for the first time in over a month yesterday, amid a growing divide between the two allies. Biden warned Netanyahu against an offensive in Rafah, where more than a million displaced Palestinians are sheltering. Here's White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
From the U.S. perspective, this is not a question of defeating Hamas. And any time I hear an argument that says, if you don't smash into Rafah, you can't defeat Hamas, I say that is a straw man. Our view is that there are ways for Israel to prevail in this conflict, to secure its long-term future, to end the terror threat from Gaza, and not smash into Rafah. That's what we're going to present in this integrated way when this team comes. We'll have it back and forth, and we'll let you know how that unfolds as we go forward.
The U.S. and its allies have also been pushing Netanyahu's government to increase the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza as signs of widespread hunger in the enclave mount. Meanwhile, lawmakers working on 6 annual spending bills have resolved a last-minute roadblock over border funding, setting the stage for Congress to review and approve the legislation ahead of a partial government shutdown this weekend. We've learned that congressional negotiators from both parties late Monday reached a deal on border security funding, though it is unclear whether that includes additional money for enforcing immigration laws as Republicans had wanted, or for the White House priorities that the GOP previously saw as deal breakers. The legislation will need to be drafted and circulated to members in coming days, potentially pushing a vote right up against the Friday funding deadline. More women are choosing the abortion pill after a clampdown on abortion rights in many US states changed when, how, and where they get abortions following the fall of Roe v. Wade in 2022. The procedure made up almost 2/3 of all abortions in the US last year, up from 53% in 2020, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. The number and rate of abortions performed in the US also climbed last year, even with near-total bans on the procedure in more than a dozen states. Access to the abortion pill has grown thanks to policy changes, including one that allows mifepristone, one of 2 drugs used in medication abortion, to be delivered by mail-order pharmacies. The Supreme Court plans to hear this month arguments to challenge the relaxation of restrictions around mifepristone. Guaranteed income programs have sprung up in cities across the US in a bid to help households with low income receive monthly payments with no strings attached. The programs reflect a growing sentiment among economists and democratic circles that this is one of the most effective ways to distribute funds and support struggling Americans. But as US policy reporter Andrew Rastuccia explains, such initiatives are drawing pushback from Republicans.
Dozens of cities and counties across the United States are implementing what they call guaranteed income programs, and that can be anywhere from $500 to $1,000. Of course, detractors worry that the money could be used for non-necessities. The data tell us, though, is that the money tends to be used in almost all cases for necessities, bills, and groceries, and things like that. This idea of giving people money directly is gaining more and more popularity across the country. On the federal level, there have been dalliances or experiments with this idea. During the pandemic, Republicans, both at the state and federal level, are working to limit or restrict these efforts, arguing that they're unfair and there's the potential for abuse of the money.
And finally, March Madness gets underway this weekend amid a push for unionization in college sports, most recently at Dartmouth. What questions do you have about that? And what does it mean for colleges, athletes, and sports in general? Send us a note, or even better, record a voice memo on your phone and send it to wnpod@wsj.com. That's wnpod@wsj.com. You can also leave us a voicemail at 212-416-4328. Just be sure to include your name and location. We might use it on the show. And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. Today's show was produced by Hattie Moyer. Our supervising producers were Christina Roker and Sandra Kilhoff. And I'm Kate Bullivant for The Wall Street Journal. We'll be back tonight with a new show. Until then, thanks for listening.